many of you are a little bit behind? And how many of you are going to catch up? All right. Good. Most of us have spent a great deal of time, particularly those of us who grew up in the church, spent a great deal of time studying about and listening about how to be saved. And back in the day, as I hear people saying these days, a preacher's challenge was to discover how many different ways he could preach the plan of salvation. He usually had exhausted all the possibilities he could muster within about 3 years, and then he moved on. I was told one time by a man whose both his father and his grandfather were preachers. He told me shortly after my arrival at this place, he said, "I've never known a preacher in my life worth his salt that stayed at a place more than 5 years." So I kind of got the hint. So those of us who grew up in the church were pretty well versed on the steps of salvation. A few years ago, when doors first began to open in countries that had recently been a part of the USSR, I was one of the leaders of groups that traveled to Belarus. The congregation where I was preaching sponsored an effort. We decided to see if we couldn't plant a church in Belarus, which is formerly a part of USSR. And so we went over in groups to teach the gospel and to try to establish a church in Brest, Belarus. And one of those groups, one of those early groups, contained an older couple in the church who were, shall I say, very familiar with the plan of salvation, with the five steps of salvation and the five acts of worship. And they were quite capable of and prepared to defend their beliefs on these subjects. They had their lessons prepared to teach students who came to our location because we had been allowed to advertise in newspapers, which has been unheard of for 40 years prior to that, that if someone wanted to learn about the Bible and be taught by American Christians, if they would be at a certain place at a certain time, then they would have that opportunity. And so we had lots of people who came. The door, that window of opportunity, first cracked at that time, and people were really excited about that opportunity. And so we broke up into the number of teachers we had. We set up tables and would have 5 to 6 students per table, and those that came would sit in an audience something like this and wait until one of the teachers had completed a couple of hour session, and then 5 or 6 people would come and sit down and you'd start over again. And it was really, really exciting times to talk to people about the Bible and about God and about Jesus who had heard a little bit about God. Much of what they had heard and been taught had obviously been negative. But it was really interesting that through all of those years of communism and being taught atheism actively, what percentage of people still retained a belief in God. It was really interesting to see that. And when they had the opportunity to express that, then it was really exciting to hear their stories, different stories about how they had hid Bibles and different ones and how they had always believed. And you got to hear lots of stories during those times. But this couple that had come with me, after about 3 days, they asked me if I would meet with them in their hotel room after the evening meal one evening. And so I went and knocked on their door and opened the door and came in and sat down. And they were really distressed. And they said to me, "Ken, we've decided that we're going home." I said, "Really? Why?" They said, "Because we're not suited for this." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And so we began to talk, and they had come prepared to be able to defend things about how do I get saved and church worship and instrumental music and those kind of things, and they were very well prepared for those kind of things. And people would listen to that, you know, because they had a prepared spiel for that. But when it was over and it was time for them to open up for questions, they never asked questions about those things. They almost always had a question that was something along the lines of, what has Christianity done for you? And they didn't know how to answer that. They didn't know how to answer that. Because they had never really sat down and thought about it from a perspective of someone who was not a Christian, who didn't know if they wanted to be a Christian or not, who had been taught that there wasn't a God, but who had retained some belief in God. And they knew the intricacies about the church and about five acts of worship and those kind of things, and they were very capable of defending those things, and they were well prepared for that, but they just did not know what to say when somebody said, tell me why I should be a Christian. They could tell you how to be a Christian, but they couldn't tell you why you should be one. I mean, they could say, well, you get to go to heaven when you die. But that really wasn't as much of a concern of these people as at least their immediate question had to do with what advantage is there to me now in being a Christian. And so they actually did catch a flight home early. And they went home because they left. And I was sad for them because they left feeling like that they had failed in what they were doing. You see, it's not just about having the right doctrine. Now, don't get me wrong. Doctrine is vital. It's imperative that we get the right doctrine. But it's about more than that. And it's not enough to have the right doctrine. It's not enough to have answers to questions that we ask ourselves. It's about that, but it's also about having the right heart and the right attitude and the right life. And it's about being real in the world. And I don't know if you're feeling what I'm feeling in the world, but I'm feeling an increased amount of hostility in our society toward Christians. And a lot of it has to do in the accusation, whether it's true or whether it's not true. The accusation has to do with Christians live in an isolated world in an ivory tower somewhere that doesn't really relate to the real world. Paul, in writing a letter to the Christians who had been scattered throughout northern Asia Minor, writes to teach them how to live in a Roman society that is hostile to Christianity. And as I read those letters and I read the history that's associated with them, then I think maybe it's not so different from what our society may be becoming today. I don't know that. I'm not a prophet. I hope I'm wrong. But that seems to be the case. Because it's not as popular to be a Christian today as it has been in my lifetime. And people openly criticize Christianity blatantly and viciously in some cases. And it has become almost the thing to do. These people were enduring severe opposition in their life in 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter, the entire letter, was written to prepare people for suffering and for persecution that came from those around them. He said, now who will want to harm you if you're eager to do good? And I kind of smile because Paul sometimes asks some questions that there seems to be an obvious answer to, but the obvious answer is not necessarily the right answer that he's looking for. Who's going to be eager to harm you? Well, there might be some people who are eager to harm you. If you're doing good. And maybe for doing good. Maybe because you're doing good, they're eager to harm you. But even, he says, if you suffer for doing what's right, God will reward you for it. So don't worry or be afraid of their threats. Instead, you must worship Christ as the Lord of your life. If someone asks you about your Christian hope, always be ready to explain it, but do this in a gentle and respectful way, and keep your conscience clear. Then if people speak against you, they'll be ashamed when they see what a good life you live because you belong to Christ. Remember, it's better to suffer for doing good if that's what God wants than to suffer for doing wrong. Now, I've just read to you 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 13 through 17 from the New Living Translation, just to give you a little different perspective of it. And by the way, it seems to be a pretty fair translation. It's a fairly recent one, and I see that some of you have purchased that. But doesn't it make sense that people on the outside looking in would be more interested about your hope than about your doctrine? Doesn't that make sense? I mean, there's an old saying, and I know you've heard it, that people don't care how much you know until what? They know how much you care. And there's a lot of truth in that, isn't there? I mean, there are a lot of really smart people in this world. And a few of them are in religious circles. There are some really smart religious people out there. But a person can be incredibly smart, and he can be incredibly religious and not make an impact on the people around him. Because it has to do with your heart. It has to do with how real you are. And can you talk to people and can you relate to people? And when somebody comes up to you and they ask you an off-the-wall question that we're not accustomed to being asked as Christians, can you sit down and talk with that person about that? And can you listen to what they have to say? And try to move that into an opportunity to share the gospel with them. Now, I want you to understand that if your hope is not rooted securely in biblical doctrine, it is a false hope. And maybe in some sense a false hope is worse than no hope because it satisfies you and you don't keep looking when you have it. And so doctrine and rightly grounded hope is essential. But I want to talk just a little bit tonight about some practical reasons to be a Christian. And I sat down and made a list myself. And I had a lot more than I'm going to cover, so I've cut about 8 points into about three. And you can put a lot more. I was thinking, you know, that would make a neat Bible class for more than one lesson to sit down and say, let's talk about some reasons why it's good to be a Christian. And so from a just really practical standpoint, I want to talk about some reasons that I'm a Christian. And one reason is because of security. Whether we know it or not, that's the thing that we most want in this life. And we look for it a lot of different ways. I tell young people that are planning to be married, one of the things that I tell them in counseling is, you probably don't know this, but the one thing that you are looking for in a marriage is you're looking for security. You're looking for the security of knowing that there is one somebody in this world who loves you more than they love anybody else in this world. That's an incredible thing to have, isn't it? And their allegiance to God does not take away from that. God's first in our lives. But as far as human relationships, to know that there is one person in this world who loves you more than they love anybody else in this entire world, that's an incredible relationship to have. And I recommend it. It's a beautiful thing to be able to grow old together. Janice and I will have been married, if we both live till tomorrow morning or till midnight tonight, we will have been married 42 years. Tomorrow is our anniversary. She always forgets it, and I never do. We were talking about that at lunch today, and she said, and I made some stupid statement like that, you know, but she said, well, let me tell you about our first anniversary. And she said, I got all dolled up, and, you know, we were going to go out, and we had made plans to go out. And he said, you know, he wanted to go fishing, so he went fishing and said, I sat there all dressed up, excited about going out on our first anniversary, and he didn't come, and he didn't come. And said by the time he finally got there, he'd caught a bunch of fish, and he was excited about it, and I didn't even want to go out anymore. Well, you know, there should be a statute of limitations after 41 years. She may not remember the date, but she remembers that for some strange reason. There are a lot of things in this world that offer security. But the truth is, there's not a single one of those things that can deliver security. Nothing. I mean zero. None. And if you stop and think about the different things in this world that offer security, then it's pretty surprising. And people have capitalized on that. I ran across something not too long ago that was about, it was an article about this person who guaranteed that you would go to heaven for $20. And his name is Peter Kuoba, and he has a website called Heaven's Registry. And for $20, he offers a guaranteed admission into heaven. And although the police have been notified about it and they're alerted to it and they consider it to be a scam, then Detective Mark Johnson admitted it'd be pretty tough to prove he's wrong. And by the way, he also offers a certificate that is available for cherished pets at a cost of $15. So you can take your cat or your dog with you when you go. But Heaven's Registry is a website that warns that only God knows which faults will keep us out of heaven. And he lists some of them. Picking a flower in the park, eating a grape at the supermarket without paying for it, breaking the law by speeding or going through a stop sign or using the Lord's name in vain or adultery and many more. And after raising this specter of uncertainty, the website promises a 100% guarantee for heavenly admission certificate. And there is, quote, no need for confession or penance. So for $20, you can go to heaven, guaranteed. 100% written, certified, guaranteed. That's just about a pretty good sum of what the world has to offer. You know it? You can get it in writing. And what does it mean? It means that it's in writing, doesn't it? And it's only as good as those who stand behind it. We buy insurance. I'm not knocking insurance, okay? I've got some of it. Why do we buy insurance? Because we want security, right? Janice and I, when she was expecting our second child, we had just gotten out of preacher school, and we had the grand total salary of $12,000 a year, and we were facing having a child, and we had a car note and we had a house note on top of, you know, other standard bills, very much like some of you back at that time. Remember, I said we'd been married for 42 years tomorrow, so that goes back a ways. And so when we found out that we're going to have a child, then we decided, okay, this last one was really kind of hard on us, you know, all these bills came due at one time, so we're going to pay these bills off really early. And so we began as soon as we knew, and we made monthly payments to the doctor and to the hospital. So that by the time that it came for that baby to arrive, we had our part paid for. And we had insurance to cover the rest of it. But there was one problem. Our insurance company went bankrupt. And so I called the insurance commissioner and I said, hey, I know that, you know, this is going to be taken care of because that just can't happen. An insurance company just can't go bankrupt, you know, and not pay. And so I called the insurance commissioner, and he said, Mr. Stegall, if what you're telling me is true, then you don't have any problem, but I'll call you back tomorrow. So I rested easy that night. The next morning he called me. He said, Mr. Stegall, you have a problem. I said, really? Why? He said, because you didn't really buy insurance. You bought into a trust. Well, it was one of those Christian deals, okay, that we had bought insurance into, and they didn't pay. And we know from recently that something is not necessarily so big that it can't go bankrupt, don't we? I mean, you know, we're carrying lots of debt because of that concept right now, but you can't carry it on and on and on forever and ever and ever. Insurance companies can go, governments can go bankrupt. So where in this world can you go to get any security? Well, most people, most of us, if we sat down and talked about the best thing that this world has to offer in the idea of security is enough money. If you have enough money, then that's about as secure as you're going to be. And we see that as the source of security. Have you ever wondered, and this is one of those stupid questions, have you ever wondered what it would be like to win the lottery? How many of us have not? Even if we don't play, I've never bought a lottery ticket in my life. But I still have wondered what it would be like to win $100 million. You know, what would I do with it? And we've probably all thought about that. Well, Jewel Whitaker, the wife of a lottery winner who took home the richest undivided jackpot in the United States history, made the following statement. I wish all of this would have never happened. I wish I would have torn the ticket up. It just doesn't give security. Money doesn't. We think it does. And that for a while, if you have a lot of it, it feels like it does. But if you live very long, you find out it doesn't. Now, I'll admit to you, it's better to have some than to not have some, okay? But it doesn't really provide security. And as you come close to the end of your life and you think about what's on the other side of death, money can't help you there, can it? And how much money would the average person give to live another year if you're facing death? Well, in most cases, it would be pretty much all you had that we would give, wouldn't we? In John chapter 10, verse 27 through 29, it says, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish. No one can snatch them out of my hand." Now, folks, that's security. It's security. It's not based on money. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5 and 6 are some words from a person who is secure. "Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, I will never leave you. I'll never forsake you. So that we may say with confidence, the Lord is my helper and I'll not be afraid." That's security. And so one of the reasons that I'm a Christian is because I want security. And I've talked to people about that who are not Christians. And then a second reason is because the thing that I fear the most in this world is removed. And what's that? Dying. The fear of death is removed. Woody Allen said, "I don't want to achieve immortality through my death. I want to do it by not dying." Well, that's not possible, is it? It is appointed unto man, what? Once to die. And after this, the judgment. The statistic is universal. One out of one does. 100% guaranteed. If the Lord doesn't come back, we're all going to meet that appointment in our life. I read another article about how to stay safe today. It says, here's how to stay safe in the world today. Avoid riding in automobiles because they're responsible for 20% of all fatal accidents. Do not stay home because 17% of all accidents occur at home. Now, you start figuring out what options you have left. Avoid walking on the streets or sidewalks because 14% of all accidents occur to pedestrians. Avoid traveling by air, rail, or water because 16% of all accidents involve these forms of transportation. Of the remaining 33%, 32% of all deaths occur in hospitals, so don't go to the hospital. You'll be pleased to learn that only 1/1,000th, that's one out of every 100,000 deaths occur in services of the church. So that's the safest place you can possibly be. Fear of death is removed. Houston Chronicle today had an article entitled, "Plastic Surgery Puts Bloom Back in Baby Boomers." Any of you read it? I thought about quoting from it, but there are some quotes that probably are not really what we need to quote from the pulpit here, but they were kind of funny because it was about centered around a 77-year-old and an 84 or 5-year-old lady who had had plastic surgery and had lots of things lifted. One of the most successful enterprises in the world today is cosmetics. Don't let those lines and wrinkles show. There's an old song, Sonny knows it, and a lot of you know it, and all these old songs tell my age because these young people have never heard of them, but it starts out, as the life of a flower, as a breath or a sigh, so the years that we live as a dream hasten by. It's kind of a sad song, isn't it? A little bit morbid in a way, but true, today we're here, but tomorrow may see just a grave in the veil and a memory of me, as a life of a flower, as a breath or a sigh, so the years glide away, and alas, we must die. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1 says, we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. That's security. And I don't have to worry about dying because I get to go home. And then a third reason, you're not going to lose what you work for. Families have watched, and we have watched in horror as tornadoes come and homes burn and hurricanes come and tsunamis come, and most of us on the internet. I just got a new picture this past week on the tsunami that came to Japan. And we've all seen some really vivid ones, but this one was taken by a home movie camera, and it was a group of people on a hill watching as the water came, and it was absolutely horrifying to watch as these houses just suddenly lifted up and all of them just started moving. And some of the people that came running out of the streets in that area didn't make it on this film. And it was pretty horrifying to watch. And you think about all the things that you've worked for, and it's very possible, and some of us in the last week have even lost a little portion of our portfolio, haven't we, as some stocks took a sizable dip here. And it can happen that it can take a lot more of a dip, can it? And the things that we've worked for all of our life, we can lose in a moment. Stocks certainly fail and banks go broke. The story of Job addresses a multitude of questions about why certain things happen in this life, and many of those questions it doesn't answer to our satisfaction. We don't want it to end where it ends. When God speaks up, we want Him to give a good definitive answer that we can get our teeth in. But there is one question that it provides an answer to, if you will accept it. And that is, what would you do if you lost everything you had tomorrow? Would there be anything left worth living for? Job answers that question. And every one of us need to answer that question in our lives. Matthew chapter 6, verse 20, you're very familiar with it. Jesus said, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust corrupts, thieves cannot break through and steal. And so, when you die as a Christian, you don't lose what you've worked for. I don't mean these physical things. These things don't last anyway. But the real things in life that matter. You don't lose. In Jesus Christ, regardless of what your present circumstances are, there's always assurance of a better tomorrow. And among those assurances is the assurance that you're not going to ever be separated from those people that you love if you're Christians. Christians never see one another for the last time. We say so long when one dies. But we have an assurance that we're going to be reunited. Is that a good reason to be a Christian? I think so. I think it's a really good reason. In fact, it gets to be a lot better reason the older I get. Because I have more invested over on that other side. Don't you? And there's some people that I really do love that I want to see again. As David said of his infant son, but now that he's dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I'll go to him, but he will not return to me. 2 Samuel 12. And these are just a few reasons, a few practical reasons why I'm a Christian. I made a long list, a lot more. We could talk about peace. We could talk about the fact that we're never alone. We can talk about the fact that we have an intercessor with God. And as we think about this, is this going to convince everybody? If you're really persuasive about this and you use the right words, is this going to persuade everybody to be a Christian? No, it's not. Because the world has a large number of reasons for not wanting to be a Christian. And it matters a lot when you enter a subject if you enter it with a mind that is bent toward accepting it or rejecting it. It matters a lot. But for those people who truly have a heart and a mind for God and God's will, and they truly do want to know, why should I be a Christian? They're thinking, first of all, about right now. What advantage is there to me now? Well, there are lots of advantages. There are lots of advantages now, and there are lots of advantages later. Living the Christian life, it does mean that you're going to forego some things. It does mean that you're going to deny yourself some things in this world that other people don't deny themselves. And so you have to ask yourself, is it worth the cost? Because there is a cost. And Jesus said, count the cost. And if you're not willing to pay the cost, don't put your hand to the plow. Because you're not going to make it. And you have to count the cost as best you can early on. But you need to know something. This world and its master is a lie. It promises what it cannot deliver. And it's sad that if you have to learn that on your own and you have to live that out on your own, then you're going to have to go all the way to the end to find out that it was all a lie that the world promised. That if you get enough money or you have enough fun or you only go around once and all the things that the world has to say. It would be really, really wise if you would listen to someone else to tell you and give you evidence that it really is to your benefit to be a Christian. There are lots of benefits in this life. And the next question, and I'll just bring it up, and I won't dwell on it, but how do I know that God can deliver on all this stuff that he says? He gives us some promises, some really incredible promises, but how do I know he can deliver? And in a word, the answer is the resurrection. That's how I know. If the resurrection is true, and all the promises are true. Everything about it. That's the crux of the matter. Let me just read you one of those promises and we'll end and sing a song of invitation in just a moment. But I want you to listen to one of the many promises that God has given in being a Christian. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, reserved in heaven for you. Through faith, you're shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. In this, you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have suffered all kinds of trials. These have come so that your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise and glory and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Well, that's a powerful passage, isn't it? If you stop and just really let that soak in. Why should I be a Christian? Well, there are lots of reasons. I tell you what, now you tell me why I shouldn't be. And let's compare while we stand and sing.
This has been in vanity.